You're listening to a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 minutes with Seanan McGuire. Hello, everyone. I'm Dave Robison.
And I'm Brian Humphrey.
And you're listening to a special showcase episode of the Roundtable Podcast, 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is a segment in which Dave and I have the great honor to sit down with some really amazing people who have done some really cool things. And today is a little bit of a different direction than what we get to do.
Every episode is a different direction.
That's true. That's true. But this one's really cool because this gets a lot closer to the stuff that I like to write. So.
Well, indeed. And Brian, let me tell you, our guest host is, dude, if there is a medium capable of conveying a story, our guest host has not only utilized it, but has mastered it and excelled in it. She is, she's the full artistic package. She's the triple threat, expressing the keen edge of her spirit through paint, pixel, and pen, producing webcomics and traditional art. As a composer, producing four CDs, and has earned no less than 5 Pegasus Awards that recognize and honor excellence in filk music. I did not misspeak myself. Friends, if you don't know what filk music is, go out to Wikipedia and educate yourselves. But of course, she is also a writer of short and long fiction and nonfiction. Just 2 short years ago, she was awarded the John W. Cannell Award for Best New Writer, which I didn't realize this, Brian, but apparently also confers upon her the title of Princess of the Kingdom of Poison and Flame.
Fabulous.
So sacrifices and tribute are welcome to her home address in California. Optional, but highly recommended. The 6th book of her 10-book series featuring the half-fae badass October Day is available for pre-order on Amazon even as we speak, Ashes of Honor. Her encrypted series was launched this year with the release of Discount Armageddon. Oh, but wait, there's more. Publishing under the pseudonym Myra Grant, readers of this of our guest host can discover her News Flesh series. Now, the first of which, titled Feed, was selected by Publishers Weekly as one of the best books of 2010 and ranked in the National Public Radio Listener Poll for the top 100 thriller novels of all time. Plus, Feed and the second book in the series, Deadline, have both received nominations for the Hugo Award for Best Novel. God, she's published a series of 12 linked stories so far in the online magazine The Edge of Propinquity. And yes, I did have to go online to learn the pronunciation for that word. Collectively titled Sparrow Hill Road, about a hitchhiking ghost seeking revenge on the man who originally was responsible for her death. And those, dear listeners, are just the high points. The Reader's Digest condensed breakdown of the creative and inspired gloriosity of our guest host. So, dear listeners, we are pleased, privileged, and pumped to welcome to the Skype line Miss Seanan McGuire. Seanan, holy crap, you must have a metric butt ton of shit going on. Thank you so much for making the time to be on the show.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Our singular pleasure. Yes. I'm going to go ahead and just note the time so we can try and stay within our 20 minutes. It'll never happen, but it's a goal that we can aspire to. and my first question is this. There are writers that write good stories, and clearly you are more than that. You are a motivated, prolific, one could even say driven artist. And I'm curious, is this just an affliction, a pathology that you're trying to work through, or are you striving for something? Is there a jewel that hangs just out of reach for you when you sit down and begin to work on a project?
Every book I write forces me to get better. Rosemary and Rue, which was the very first book I wrote, I'm still pleased with it. I don't cringe when I read it. You know, it sold for a reason. It's a solid book. I can say that without feeling like I'm being braggy. But if I look at it now, I want to rewrite it. I want to revise it. I'm like, I can fix everything! And there are books that I genuinely was not good enough to write until I wrote six other books to kind of build up the lifting muscles necessary. There's a deconstructed timeline book called The Nativity of Chance that I really want to write. And I've been writing other things to figure out how to do the pace changes that I'm going to have to pull off for this book, which all leads up to a different book I want to write called Cathedrals, where I need to be juggling 73 different timelines. And I'm going to have to do some pretty heavy lifting before I can write that book and have it work. I have the very strong motivation of I like to feed my cats.
Sure.
Which is a horrible motivation because people do kind of have that belief that authors can feed on moonbeams and adulation. but at the end of the day, I need to be finishing and publishing three books a year, and they need to be good enough that people will read them and come back for another one.
Right.
Because I have really big cats and they will eat my ass.
Well, one of them is a Maine Coon, right?
Two of them are Maine Coons.
Oh my God, those are like the leonine girth cats of the feline set.
Yeah, there was actually a thing last week where a guy called in to animal control that there was a cougar in his backyard.
Oh my God!
And the news ran a report about it and had to run a retraction 2 days later with a big thing that said "not a cougar" over pictures of this Maine Coon. You know, I like not being eaten.
Sure.
But apart from that, I do have one affliction. It's a tragic affliction. I think in series. Like the Newsflesh trilogy, which is 300-500-page books, was my attempt to write a standalone. you think I'm kidding. My friends don't think I'm kidding. They just look kind of sad. And it really is, if I slow down, I'm not going to finish my series before my natural death of old age.
So you really are driven.
Really am. I don't want to die leaving these things unfinished. I don't want to be sitting in the afterlife watching my publishers hire someone I don't like to write the last three volumes from my notes while I'm going, no, no, not her! Oh, God! Because that is what actually starts the zombie apocalypse.
Oh,
is me coming back to finish my books because you can't touch them.
All right, everybody leave Shannon alone. Let her finish her damn books so we don't have to endure the zombie apocalypse. Awesome. Yes. Well, and actually, Shannon, that because you because of your proclivity towards series, that actually leads very nicely. Denise, I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name, just asked a question on Twitter that I wanted to offer up because you are clearly uniquely qualified to answer this. How do you keep characters from going stale in a series and at the same time kicking their ass in each book?
Well, how do you keep your friends from going stale and keep on kicking their ass? I mean, a lot of it is you can't give a character everything they want in book one. If you've ever done any role-playing gaming, if you've ever been in a D&D game or a Champions game, anything like that, you know that when you make a character, they have goals. They have things that they want, and they have things that they hope will happen to them. And a good GM does not give you every single one of those things at the end of the session. Not unless it was a one-shot and this character's done forever. With a character, they have goals, they have things that they want, and you just can't give them everything.
Right.
If you're lucky, you can make a complex enough protagonist that that's not going to be a problem for a long time. Now, minor characters do get stale. Minor characters do hit the point where you're like, wow, I needed someone that knew how to work a toaster, so I created you, and you just won't leave. And that's why God gave us C4. Killing people is always a great way to freshen things back up because now you've got a corpse. And corpses don't require dialogue in most universes. but seriously, a lot of it is denying your characters things. Toby, over in my October Day series, all she really wants is a cup of coffee, a sandwich, and for you to go the fuck away. And the first thing I do in any October Day book is I take away her coffee, I don't let her get a sandwich, and I refuse to let anybody go the fuck away. And it's amazing how fresh and irritated she stays based on that. You also need to realize that some characters are not here to sustain a 10-book series. Over in Encrypted, which you mentioned launched this last March, my first protagonist is Verity Price. And she has the first two books, which is Discount Armageddon and Midnight Blue Light Special. And those are both from her point of view, focusing on her. But book three goes to her brother, Alex.
Ah.
And so books 3 and 4, we're going to be following Alex doing other things and dealing with other situations. And that's because, honestly, if I tried to write 5 books straight through of Verity, we would kind of hit the point where, and this is the book where Verity sits in a rest stop and glares at the author for 300 pages.
But a dynamic and exciting 300 pages, to be sure.
No, probably not. There might at some point be tourists with an annoying terrier. I don't know, but it's not a book I want to write.
Yeah. What is the book you want to write, Shannon?
Not that.
Well, okay. Not that. Cool.
I'm generally writing the book I want to write in 3 or 4 different genres at any given time. Usually the book I want to write is the sequel to the book I am writing, and that's how I know I'm still enthusiastic about that universe.
Sure.
When I hit the point where the book I want to be writing is this book because I want to fucking finish this stupid thing, all right, oh God, then I need to step back and figure out where my enthusiasm has gone.
Good point. Excellent point.
You brought up something that we deal with a lot in the workshop episodes. When you said, you know, you give your main character something that she wants and then you take it away from her. And that's how you generate conflict, right? So how do you determine, because we deal with this all the time. We're always asking our writers, okay, what does your protagonist want? What is it that is driving them to give you that motivation through the entire story? But how do you determine whether or not that need or that want is enough to propel the story along? Because sometimes that, you know, that need may not be strong enough for a reader to really care all that much.
Well, the initial want doesn't need to be the full-on propulsion.
Right.
The initial want just needs to get them to where you can kick in with want or compulsion number 2. For example, Rosemary and Rue, Toby wants a cup of coffee, which I refuse to let her have. She wants to be left alone, which I refuse to allow to happen. And then because of the need for coffee and the attempt at solitude, she winds up in a position where really what she wants is for people to stop trying to shoot her. And that's a lot easier to sustain for a book-length work. You can also go with wants that are based on basically setting, based on not so much situation as environment. What Verity wants is to keep the cryptids of the world and the humans of the world from killing each other. She's a social worker for supernatural shit. And this is continually going to keep driving her into places where I can start shooting at her. I don't ever need to complicate her wants. I do, but I don't need to.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, why is Verity there? Well, Verity is there because she's attempting to explain to the harpies why they can't dive bomb planes. And that will get me to the starting situation.
Okay.
I think the best way to figure out what a character wants, if you don't already know, is frequently free writing. There are pages and pages and skeins of text that no one will ever see because it's Toby goes to the grocery store. And what kind of soup does Toby want? Okay, good. Soup is not a major motivator.
Right.
And that's a good way to learn your character and learn how they'll react to things without having to commit it to the text of a novel, to your actual, well, it is in continuity for me, but to the continuity that anyone else ever sees. You know, keep in mind, none of us sees anyone else 24 hours a day, so that doesn't have to go for fictional people either.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. We'll be back with more of our conversation with Shannon McGuire after this promotional break.
When the aliens known as the Hezrin invaded our solar system, we were defenseless against their power and technology. But at our darkest hour, from the mind of a mad genius, came our salvation, the Titans. Using nanotechnology that turned ordinary soldiers into armored warriors with the strength to tear starships in half, the Titans not only repelled the alien invaders, but vowed to chase them across the galaxy until the Hezrin were destroyed. That was 100 years ago. Neither the Titans nor the Hezrin have been heard from since. Now, finally, the Titans have returned. But instead of coming home as conquering heroes, they've been infected by a virus that's driven them insane and compelled them to destroy everything they'd fought so long and hard to protect. Standing between them and humanity's destruction is a scholar, her son, and the only Titan able to resist the infection. Will they find a way to save humanity from its own greatest weapon? Matthew Wayne Selznick, author of The Sovereign Era Story World, says Haywire is sure to satisfy cravings for Saturday matinee high adventure space fantasy. And Alan Baxter, author of Realm Shift and Mage Sign, has called Haywire a thrilling chase through a superbly realized future solar system. Enhanced warriors, space pirates, galactic threats, and more make this a powerful debut from a strong new voice in speculative fiction. Haywire is a science fiction adventure novel written by Justin R. McCumber and published by Griffinwood Press. It's available online in print and ebook formats from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Smashwords, and the Apple iBook Store. You can learn more about the author at his website, justinmccumber.com.
Now, let's get back to the conversation with Seanan McGuire. Seanan, you gave a great interview with Chuck Wendig over at TerribleMinds.com.
I love Chuck.
Chuck, we got to get him on the show one of these days.
Yes.
And in that interview, you explained that Myra Grant?
Mira.
Mira. See, I knew I was pronouncing that wrong.
If it were Myra, it would be spelled with a Y.
Ah, good point. This is Mira. Mira Grant is for your darker and geekier storylines. And we know several writers who have contemplated cultivating a pseudonym to explore different genres so as not to confuse their fans. And You've been doing this for a while, so I'm wondering if you could share with them, how is that working out for you? And do you have any advice on how they can make it work for them?
It's working fantastically.
Cool.
And the few times it hasn't worked has shown me in great big glowing neon letters, oh my God, why it was the best idea ever. I've never made any secret of the fact that I am Mira and Mira is me. If you go to Mira's website, there's a picture of me and a link to my bibliography page. If you go to my website, Mira's works are listed on my bibliography. I mean, it's very open.
Sure.
It's very hard to get confused, but some people do. Or some people that are not into looking at authors' websites, you know, they hear from a friend, oh, that Mira girl also wrote some books as Seanan, I think it is. Or Seanan also wrote some books as Myra, I don't know. And then they go and they read the genre that is not their thing. And they're not doing it because they love me as an author. They're doing it because they heard that might be the same person. And that's when Seanan gets the email that is, oh my God, I picked up the book because I thought it was going to be, and then maybe there would be, but oh my God, zombies! Ah! I'm never reading you again! And Mira gets the email going, did you know that there were like icky, girly fairies in this book? Because I think your publisher put them in without your knowledge. Which is an actual email I received from someone who wanted me to know that my publisher had rewritten my gritty noir mystery to insert icky girly fairies. I'm like, well, no, actually, I majored in folklore and mythology. They're not very girly. They are kind of icky. Put them in there myself. Peace right. out, yo. So that the fact that that happens, even with the pseudonym, makes me go, oh, God, if I had just put this out into the world and had not warned people, the dark place in which I lived would not be very pleasant. My standard response, and it is standard because it is accurate, is that I am Mira Grant for the same reason that in the early 90s, Disney became Touchstone. Touchstone so that they could release R-rated movies and not have parents taking their kids to see Walt Disney's Reservoir Dogs, which you know would have happened.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And,
sure.
And
absolutely.
Then Disney would have gotten the angry, angry emails.
Branding works.
In terms of doing it yourself, the first thing you need to do is find a name that you can sign. Mira Grant has a big M and a big G. McGuire has a big M and a big G.
Ah,
nice.
So it makes signing those books much easier. I actually wanted to be Samantha Grant, but someone else had that .com. And it is very unlikely that any publisher will let you choose a pseudonym where you can't get the .com.
Right. Mm.
Right. Okay. You mentioned that you majored in folklore and mythology, and that takes me into a question that is burning for me in terms of things like urban fantasy and this type of genre in general. And that's what, when you're looking or when you're writing a book that deals with something like fairy, what resources do you use? And how do you bring in you know, how do you make that choice in terms of which pieces you're going to bring in that are reliable elements of mythology, and how do you decide then when it's okay to kind of go off script and use new and original elements that you're coming up with on your own without pissing off your base? You know what I mean?
Well, I majored in folklore and mythology at the University of California, Berkeley. Go Bears! And one of the things that taught me was that there is so much folklore and so much mythology that if you tried to kitchen sink it all, it would not work. You would explode. It would be worse than World of Darkness 2nd Edition when they started making everything playable ever. It really would. It'd be like, yeah. And we are the Salubri! Okay, I gotta go now. There are so many resources, and it really depends on where you want to focus. So the first thing that you need to do is stop and go, where am I? The biggest strength, research-wise, of the Toby Day series, which is also the biggest weakness, inclusivity-wise, of the Toby Day series, is that I made the conscious decision that I would only use folkloric settings that could be explained as a part of the Celtic folklore of the British Isles and the fairy folklore of Western Europe.
Okay.
And that was because I had a single point of origin. My fairy has a single point of start. So I can't use the folklore from a lot of regions because it does not reconcile well with fairy. I can't use Native American folklore. I can't use a lot of South American folklore. It doesn't work when you're talking about it in the context of fairy. So that means that, you know, some people have said, and quite rightly, that the Toby Day books are just another Celtic mythology-a-thon. And they're Teutonic, too! Yay! but they are very limited and very Eurocentric in scope. At the same time, it means that I don't have to go, how do I explain why there aren't any vampires here? There aren't any vampires here because vampires aren't fairies. There are some blood-sucking fairies. There are some shape-shifting fairies. There are no werewolves. There are no vampires. There may be lake monsters, but they will be very much fairy lake monsters. If you want to do something in that area, if you want to be working in the Celtic and the Germanic and that whole part of Europe, which I know that's an incredibly insulting statement, but I can't really list off countries for 20 minutes or y'all will shoot me.
and we thank you
for it. There was a lady named Catherine Briggs who wrote really some of the seminal works on that area. Her Folklore of the British Isles, which is a 4-volume set that just makes me so happy. I finally own my own copy because I went to Minnesota and raided the library of the retiring Minnesota state folklorist, thus pissing off Bill Willingham.
Congratulations.
Thank you, is absolutely seminal. She studied English at Oxford. She wrote The Personnel of Fairyland, The Anatomy of Puck, The Folk Tales of England, Fairies in Tradition and Literature, and an Encyclopedia of Fairies in British Folklore. She was president of the English Folklore Society, and I really, really recommend her if you're going to work in that part of the world. That kind of was my area of specialization, which gave me a lot of starting research material. Encrypted is more general. I've taken a very kitchen sink approach with encrypted in that if I can give you a pseudoscientific explanation of something, I can have it.
Nice.
And there, my delimiter, my limiting factor has been, must be able to have a pseudoscience explanation.
Right. And by pseudoscience explanation, how much of that is I guess my hang up is, you know, like I don't hate to admit it. I actually enjoy the show, but we're watching, you know, True Blood, and every fucking person in that show is something. Like, there are no humans left at this point. But I get swept into it and I buy it. And I know that a lot of it is just made up and not necessarily based on anything. And so, like, even to say, you know, that you have a pseudoscientific explanation, how much of that is just made up?
Oh, it's all made up.
Okay,
but it's
good.
Necessary for me to feel that it fits into the universe.
Definitely.
Also, I love the idea of a supernatural setting where we've run out of humans, but everyone is still pretending to be human for the sake of the humans.
Right, right.
Because that's just brilliant. That's like, okay, I got it. My friend Kate and I, when we get confused, we say that we're alien anthropologists and that we're all here to study humans. But what no one realizes is that we're all studying the other anthropologists, because all of the humans are in Warsaw, Indiana. Just like, it's the small little human reserve. That's all that's left. And that's why we think humans are so weird, because we're just studying other anthropologists and none of us are doing human quite right.
That's awesome.
Love it.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I'm doing there is I'm actually sitting down with my various cryptid species and saying, okay, how can I biologically justify you? There's a field guide on my website where I give you the scientific classification of things that don't exist.
Wow.
Nice.
You have literally created a whole world and gone into realms that may never actually appear in a story, but serve to flesh out and give credence and a framework for the stories that you are telling.
Yes. And also it means that I get to commission Corey Bing, who is fantastic and I love her. I get to give a friend of mine money in exchange for drawing the bizarre cryptid creatures that show up in one of my books. And thus does she have money, and I have pictures of poison dart frickins.
And everybody's happy.
Yes.
Awesome. Shannon, just one last quick question, because the time is ticking down dreadfully fast. What is it about urban? I mean, most of the canon of your work is clearly falling into the realm of urban fantasy. And you could just as easily have gone in and told a pure fantasy tale in a fantasy realm and drawn in the Celtic and the Fae and the mythology and worked that as well. What is it about urban fantasy that captures your attention time and time again in the telling of your stories?
So, again, I was a folklore major. I studied fairy tales with the intent that what I would be telling as a profession, as a professional woman, would have been fairy tales, that I would be working with these for my entire life. Fairy tales are urban fantasy that's aged out. When Little Red Riding Hood was new, when we were telling this story to our kids, we lived in little houses on the edge of deep, dark forests, and you could walk for a day before you saw a neighbor. When Jack and the Beanstalk was new, we were starving because our farms had one bad season. And there was a real temptation to, and if you get some magic beans, you can go to the kingdom in the clouds. You know, those were urban fantasy when they were new. And it's just that the urban environment around them has changed. Just like Pride and Prejudice, which is a cute period piece now that informs so much of our modern romantic sensibility. When it was written, that was a modern setting.
Huh.
And so what I am doing, for me, is I'm writing fairy tales. It's just that they're new. So of course they take place now.
Right.
And that would be Dave's epiphany moment for this particular episode. Holy crap, I had never considered that, but you're absolutely right. It's just a matter of perspective and context. That's so cool.
That's awesome.
And on that note, as much as I hate to say it, holy crap, Seanan, clearly this could go on all morning long, but the time has ticked down and we must wrap this up. Thank you so much for making the time and for sharing so many wonderful insights. I know our listeners are going to be delighted, and Brian and I are as well. Thank you.
Absolutely, yes.
Very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Awesome.
Definitely.
Awesome. Brian, you've been scribbling notes, right?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Me too. Even though we can play this back, notes are being taken. This is awesome.
I've got boxes and multiple underlines and stars. And I've got a lot of research to do after this, so.
Fabulous. Friends, thank you so much. I hope that was as awesome for you as it was for us. We're going to go have a cigarette now and bask in the afterglow of this interview. Do stick around. In a couple of days, we'll have Seanan back. She will workshop a very cool story. And we will continue with the awesomeness and the exploration that is the Roundtable Podcast. In the meantime, if you're bored, I highly recommend popping out to the iTunes zone and hitting a rate button or possibly leaving a review. If you have some comments or observations for Seanan, you can leave a comment out on the website for this particular post at roundtablepodcast.com. Drop us a line at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. We would love to hear from you. And in the meantime, Brian, suggestions, ideas for something they might do between now and the next episode?
I love when you set me up for that, because you're long-winded in your setup, and then I only have two words to say, and that's right. Go right.
Go right. See, and that's why I'm Laurel and you're Hardy, or you're Hardy and I'm Laurel.
Wait. Are you calling me the fat one?
I don't know. I'm the fat one because
I don't remember which
one. But be that as it may, friends, have fun. Do take care of yourselves. Go right, and we will see you in a couple of days. Take care. Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast, or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.